Welcome. My name is Winsome Waite, and I'm Senior Director on the Policy to Practice team here at the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thanks for being with us today for our second webinar on the OECD Test for Schools. Developed by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD Test for Schools is a school-level test based on the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA. School leaders who give the assessment receive a rich report that allows them to consider academic outcomes in the context of student-teacher relationships, student motivation, and student self-efficacy, while comparing their students' performance to peers around the world. The OECD Test for Schools and the report allow educators to develop a roadmap for continuous change and improve student achievement. The Alliance's new report, the OECD Test for Schools, How Three School Systems Are Improving Student Achievement, profiles two school districts and one school that use the Test for Schools to monitor student academic outcomes and inform teaching practice to meet student learning needs. Today's webinar features one of those school districts, Gwinnett County Public Schools in Georgia, one of the 15th largest school districts in the U.S., with over 55,000 high school students of diverse backgrounds. The school district has used the Test for Schools since 2014. Today, we will hear how the leaders use the results to drive improvement and prepare their young people for success in an increasingly globalized economy. But before we get to them, a few details. Please join the conversation via Twitter using the hashtag OECDPISA. You can also ask questions using that hashtag or via the box below this video window. Today's event will be archived at allfored.org/webinars. To find out more about the Global Learning Network, of which Gwinnett County is a part, please visit globallearningnetwork.americaachieves.org. And about the OECD Test for Schools, please go to nwea.org/OECD. Lastly, thank you to the Kern Family Foundation for its support of the Alliance's work around PISA and the OECD Test for Schools. Now, let me introduce our guests. To my right is the author of the issue brief, Dr. Ashley Berner. Ashley is Deputy Director of the Johns Hopkins Institute for Education Policy and Assistant Professor of Education at Hopkins. Ashley has written extensively on the relationship between educational structure and state funding in democratic nations, religious education, and citizenship formation. She has addressed teacher preparation in different national contexts. Ashley's new book, Pluralism and American Public Education, No One Way to School, was recently published by Palgrave Macmillan. Thanks for being here today, Ashley, and for the great work you've done on the brief.
It's a pleasure.
And joining us via Skype are two educators from Gwinnett County Schools in Georgia. We have Karen Johnson from the Research and Evaluation Office of the school district, where she has worked for 11 years. Thanks for being here, Karen. And John Campbell has spent 34 years at Gwinnett County Schools, where he was principal of five different buildings, opened three new schools, spent 5 years as the director of staff development and student support services, and now serve as the district's OECD support mentor. It's great to have both of you, John and Karen. At this time, we will hear from Ashley, who has a presentation on the report. So now, over to you, Ashley.
Well, thank you so much for having me here, Winsome. It's a pleasure to see you again and to meet our partners in Gwinnett County with whom I got to speak during the research on this report. So just to back up for a moment, this OECD Test for Schools is based on the PISA, the International Assessment, which is given by the OECD to its partner nations. Now it's some 80 nations, some of which are members of the OECD, some of which are partners, some 80 nations that take the same assessment every 3 years, and the assessment covers reading, math, and science for 15-year-old students. It also includes, very importantly, a 30-minute student survey that probes questions about the educational background of the students, the relationships they have with their teachers, and their perceptions of their teachers' support for their work. Why is the PISA important? It's important because it shows different countries where they stand in an increasingly global economy. And the United States has typically come in the middle of the pack internationally. We are slightly above the OECD average in reading and science, slightly below in math. And the OECD is also predictive of adult skills and well-being. This is one of the fascinating things the OECD does, is it also tests surveys, I should say, in a different assessment, adults who are working in the economy up to the age of 66. And they have been able to correlate the performance on PISA as a 15-year-old with skills in the workforce later. So it's very important. Now, one of the limitations of the PISA is that it gives countrywide data, but not school-level data, and not even state-level data, unless you're Massachusetts, which oversamples its students and is therefore able to have a state-level PISA score. So the partners at the America Achieves and the NWEA have created this OECD test for schools in partnership with OECD, which individual districts and schools can administer not just every 3 years, but every year in every subject and with the same very rich student survey. Now, just a few examples from the test itself. The questions on the PISA are different in kind from those on most state summative exams. So they are interactive. They are designed to explore how students are able to use the knowledge that they have and apply them in novel situations. So this is just one example from a science assessment. This is called running in hot water, and students have to respond in an computer adaptive version in particular to different scenarios and different responses based on their answers. The other component is, of course, this final 150-page report that schools receive that marry the academic data with the student demographic data. And this is what I find one of the most exciting components of the OECD test for schools. And I'm sure that John and Karen will give more details about how they use this information for continuous learning in their schools. So when you receive the 150-page report, which is not a walk in the park to read, it gives you not only the sense of how your students are doing in any given subject, but how they compare to similar students with similar demographic backgrounds in other United States contexts and around the world. And it's not simply diagnostic. It is also a resource for improvement. So, for example, if one finds that your male 15-year-olds are having trouble in a particular domain of math, the OECD report may say, teachers in Mexico faced a similar issue, and here's how they solved it. So it is positive and forward-looking. Also gives you details about, for example, that not merely your students' proficiency levels, but their actual type of engagement with the subject. So this is one of my favorite charts. What kinds of readers do you have in your school? Do they read a lot at a very surface level? Do they read very deeply within one subject, or do they do both? And how can we bring everybody up on the scale towards the deep and wide? That's just one example. So I was very excited to have an opportunity to explore this test and the results, and I look forward to, as I know you will, hearing from Gwinnett County, which makes very good use of the data they receive. So Gwinnett County, a few facts about their district. It is the largest district in Georgia. There are 21 high schools and 55,000 students. 69% of the students are students of color, and 48% qualify for free or reduced price lunch. It's a very high performing district, and thank you.
So thank you, Ashley, for very informative and insightful information on the OECD test for schools, and particularly in Gwinnett County. So let me ask you a follow-up question. You're a student of school improvement and reform. What does the research say about effective district improvement strategies, mm-hmm. and how does the test for school play into those?
So as you know, most of the research is really focused on school improvement strategies as opposed to district reform strategies. When we talk about district reform strategies, we tend to think about three different types of interventions. There's a structural reform in which the schools are either given to charter operators or extended day and so on. So you would have the I-zone, as in Memphis, for example, or New Orleans charterizing many of the schools in their district. So that's the structural side. Then you can have district-wide reforms in how teachers are evaluated and rewarded. So this would be, for example, the impact system of teacher evaluation that you all have here in Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. Now, those are two strategies that have some research support. As with everything in education, it depends on a lot of complicating factors. There's another domain of district improvement that is geared towards curriculum and teaching. And this lever is a policy lever that I think is not used enough, but is increasingly on the radar of state and district policymakers for several reasons. First of all, it all comes down to what happens in the classroom. How do you actually improve those interactions and the academic learning that's going on? And curriculum and instructional practices are perhaps one of the most cost-effective ways to boost student learning and narrow the achievement gap. So there are examples around the country right now. We have Massachusetts, which in the 1990s and early 2000s improved its instructional practices and its instructional program to great effect. Louisiana has done this recently as a state. They're implementing widespread curricular changes and supporting teachers in that. Duval County, Florida is doing the same thing. So when you look at those three different district improvement strategies, I think the OECD test for schools clearly falls in that last category of focusing on instructional practices and high-end academic discussions. And I think although there's no research, at least no causal research, on the OECD test for schools, I think it's a promising strategy, and I would imagine it will be used increasingly.
Wonderful. Thank you for delving into that curriculum and instructional piece. Mm-hmm. Now, John, I know you also have a few slides to share with us from Gwinnett on the test for schools there and the work that you do. So over to John from Gwinnett County.
Hi, glad to join you. Certainly enjoyed your comments, Ashley. The Gwinnett County Public Schools is a huge school district of over 160,000 students, and we mentioned before how many were in the high school. But over 10 years ago, our superintendent school board developed our vision and mission statements, which kind of helped set the pattern, the path for us to get involved in an international benchmarking. Our mission statement clearly stated our desire to have a culture of continuous improvement while holding ourselves accountable to the highest standards possible. Then our vision statement, developed at the same time as our mission statement, states we will be a system of world-class schools. This implies each school within our district will set a world-class benchmark and achieve it. Notice we also commit ourselves to preparing students to be college and career ready. Now, we have made significant progress towards achieving our vision and mission. It was certainly easier to get a benchmark on our state, local, state, and national standards, but getting a benchmark on the international standards was the challenge. But despite unprecedented growth and major demographic changes, our schools are consistently among the top performers in the state, and we actually won the Broad Prize for Excellence in Urban Education 2 times and were recently named the Advanced Placement District of the Year. So we have all those benchmarks against local and national standards, but until recently, it was very difficult to find a world-class measure for schools. The PISA provided such a measure, but the results for the PISA were for the nation, not for a school district, and certainly not for individual schools. Now, I personally became interested in the PISA about 8 years ago while serving as a school principal after reading Tony Wagner's book, The Global Achievement Gap. After reading Mr. Wagner's book, I researched the PISA and found many of the questions used in previous assessments were made available to the public. The document-based questions clearly measured students' abilities to think critically, to solve real-life problems, and to communicate. I began using the public PISA questions to challenge my staff to use the public PISA questions to enrich and extend our instruction. We quickly learned how to adapt our instructional practices to prepare students to perform on these more rigorous assessments. Our school performance on all assessments improved while we were doing this. So as we were working on developing PISA-like questions and the instruction required to prepare students for those, our performance on every other assessment improved during that time. In the meantime, our superintendent, Mr. Alvin Wilbanks and Mr. Jack Dale, and other highly respected superintendents, asked the OECD to develop a PISA for schools. At that time, that's when the OECD test for schools became available to us. Now, my role is an interesting one, because our superintendent, Alvin Wilbanks, offered me the opportunity to return from my recent retirement with the offer of a part-time position designed to familiarize other schools in our district with the rigor found in the OECD test for schools. I have to lead this effort by influence and by convincing school personnel that this work will pay big dividends in improving student performance on a wide variety of assessments. Georgia's previous state assessment was found to be lacking in rigor when results were compared to students' performances on the NAEP. Georgia changed their state assessment to begin to include constructed response items, requiring students to cite evidence and/or provide reasoning in support of their answers. The new state assessment, called the Milestones, also began to include more document-based questions, where students had to read a passage or interpret charts, graphs, and tables to answer questions. This format of document-based questions, combined with the requirement for students to construct answers, made my job of promoting the OECD Test for Schools units much easier. Now, one challenge we faced was the overwhelming responsibility our teachers felt for teaching the curriculum, teaching our standards, which is largely about knowing content. What I noticed is that each PISA unit begins with stimulus material, or as we call them, documents. The stimulus material almost always presents material matching our content standards, and that's key, because the stimulus material is in the subject areas of reading, math, and science, and they often match the same content that we are trying to get our students to learn. So at that point, I had curriculum directors examine each document or stimulus material and match it to the most appropriate content standard in our existing curriculum. These units or stimulus materials, along with the questions and answers, were then placed in our online communication centers. That's a center that our teachers use often to get information about what's going on in the district. And teachers also have very easy access to it. Now, the key difference is the questions and the scoring guides that come with the stimulus material. The documents are designed to measure, again, students' abilities to think critically, solve real-life problems, and communicate. So what I'm trying to convince teachers of is that when you use this material, it helps elevate the instruction to those key areas of critical thinking and problem solving and communication while you're still covering the required content that we need. Now, the next thing we had to do is decide where we're going to do most of our work. And since the OECD test for schools is given to 15-year-olds, and since most 15-year-olds are very early in their high school experience, it was decided our best leverage point was in middle school. I usually begin with the school administrative team. If I do a good job of convincing them, I'm invited back to present to teacher leaders. When schools feel this can help them achieve their own goals, I'm invited back to begin the work with teachers. Now, one of the first things I ask teachers to do is to go into those curriculum communication centers I mentioned earlier and find the public PISA items they feel address the content that they are teaching and that they also would feel comfortable using a classroom problem-based learning activity. We then discuss their lesson plan. We talk about how do you introduce a problem-based activity to students to pique their interest. How do we model the thinking that the teacher uses when approaching this kind of problem? How to get students to work individually, then in pairs, and then in groups, and agree on their answers to these questions. We also work on how to construct a response, a written response that addresses the question and provides evidence or sound reasoning. Then the last step is editing that question, working through the editing process to making sure that we have chosen the best answer that clearly answers the question. Hopefully, our next step would begin the work of developing our own PISA-like units or questions. We identify key concepts we want students to learn. We find or create stimulus material, which stretches students but does not overwhelm them. And then we create questions designed to promote inference, analysis, evaluation, synthesis, and problem solving. So that's our adventure, and that's what I'm working on here in the Gwinnett County Public Schools. Now, we have 25 middle schools, and I've visited most of them, and I have begun the kind of granular work with some of our teachers in some of the schools as well. And it's quite interesting and quite fun.
Wow. Thank you so much, John. And as a former middle-level educator myself, I'm really interested in that point about the middle school. So just want to ask you a bit more on that. How is it going, and do you ever see this work reaching down to elementary schools?
I think it's going great. I'm getting a very positive response from our teachers. Now, one of the problems we have is I have to convince them that this work will actually translate into improved performance on assessments that they are held accountable for. And I think I've made that connection for them. Now, with elementary schools, I'm not there yet. We're such a big district. I'm just trying to get some good experiences with middle schools, and I hope word of mouth will spread and this will begin to move down. But at the same token, our district is redeveloping their own assessment program, and their questions are beginning to look a lot more like PISA OECD questions now.
Fabulous. Thank you so much, John. So let me turn to your colleague, Karen, who does work there in Gwinnett County using the Test for Schools data. So Karen, if you would just share with us your few points at this minute, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you, Winsome. Excuse me. And I'm quite happy to be here speaking about something I feel quite passionate about. Ashley mentioned about the large book of information, the school reports that each of our 20 high school principals receive. And we get that from the OECD and our test provider partner, NWEA. And each research office receives a detailed data file as well that goes with those school reports. We've always benchmarked our school performance against high-achieving schools, as John mentioned, but when the opportunity for international benchmarking came to us, we were quite excited to jump on board, and administering the test became a priority to our Board of Education, our CEO superintendent, and our leadership team. 2014, we started with 11 schools taking the test. The academic achievement section's cognitive challenge aligns with our ongoing work to enhance our district's already high standards of rigor in curriculum, teaching and learning, and assessment. The second section of the test, the student survey, is as important to our superintendent and leadership as the academic achievement section. I'm going to be going through some of these slides rather fast, just because of the time constraint, but please contact me if you have any questions about any of the information or slides I present. Looking at achievement, this next graph compares our district average score results in reading, math, and science to results from PISA 2015 for the U.S., OECD countries and economies, and Canada. Throughout each school report, a high school's performance is compared to U.S. performance, but many comparisons are also made with results from the highest and lowest performing countries, and scores from every country are available to us in the appendix of the school reports. We chose to compare our district results to Canada's achievement, believing that Canadian culture, students, and high schools are more similar to our own than other countries. You can see over the 3 years of testing shown here that our district results have fluctuated a small amount in each subject, but overall are fairly consistent from year to year. Compared to the US and OECD schools, our district mean scores are almost always higher, and especially compared to US math scores. However, Canadian performance surpasses Gwinnett, the US, and the mean of the OECD countries and economies. I'd like to spend a few minutes highlighting some more examples of how our district and school leaders use the information we receive from the test for schools. As mentioned, the school reports contain many graphs and tables, and taken from a 2016 report, this graphic allows this Gwinnett County school to compare their reading results to the most recently available scores from the U.S., Shanghai, and Mexican high schools. Ashley showed us a similar slide, but for mathematics. Looking across this school's reading score of 527 places this school within the top 25% of U.S. schools' performance, in the bottom 25% of Shanghai schools' performance, and above nearly all Mexican schools. The OECD states, and our district agrees, that it is important to consider performance not only in absolute terms, but also to look at performance compared to similar schools. This next scatter plot contains information about reading performance and socioeconomic background, or SES. Reading performance for this graph is on the vertical axis. The reading score increases as you go up from bottom to top. The SES for this graph is on the horizontal axis. SES is measured by the PISA Index of Economic, Social, and Cultural Status, the ESCS Index, and it increases along the horizontal axis as you go from left to right, from minus 3.0 on the left, very disadvantaged, to 0, the OECD average in the center, to plus 3.0, socioeconomically advantaged on the far right of the bottom horizontal axis. This is where I really wish I had a pointer, but since I don't, please contact me if you have questions. Each bubble in this scatter plot represents the reading score and the SES of a U.S. school. Keep in mind that some of these bubbles may represent a couple of schools with the results on top of each other. As SES improves, the reading scores increase. The dark line in the middle of the U.S. schools represents the best relationship between reading performance and SES. The red dot is our same Gwinnett school that we saw in the previous slide, with a reading score of 527 and a socioeconomic background on the PISA index of plus 1.06. This graph illustrates that although the reading mean of 527 is a fairly good score, if you compare this Gwinnett School score to U.S. schools with similar socioeconomic backgrounds, which are shown within the blue vertical band, this school is actually performing below many of those schools, performing below the dark line. Or put another way, many U.S. schools that are similarly advantaged socioeconomically are outperforming this school in reading. The next graph is exactly the same as this graph, except there's a different Gwinnett school represented by the red dot. Again, reading performance is shown in context of socioeconomic status. This school's reading score is 463. Its SES PISA index is minus 0.4, below the OECD average of 0. This graph illustrates that although the reading score of 463 is lower than the previous schools, if you compare this school's place in the group to U.S. schools with the same disadvantaged socioeconomic background shown within the blue vertical band, this school is actually performing better than many similar U.S. schools and is slightly above the dark line. This school would be exhibiting what PISA calls academically resilient students, that is, disadvantaged students who perform better than predicted by those, their socioeconomic status. And Ashley referenced this in the case study she wrote. Up until now, we've been examining average or mean scores alone and in the context of poverty. In the OECD test for school reports, the PISA scales are also divided into proficiency levels. As the OECD states, and we agree, the proficiency levels provide a more meaningful picture of what our students are expected to know and what they can do at different levels of performance. School reports contain tables shown on the top of this graph, on this slide, and also graphic representations of proficiency levels shown on the bottom. The data shown in this slide represent only 1 year, 2016. There are 7 proficiency levels, and they range from below 1 to level 6. In the top left table, these 7 levels for reading proficiency are grouped into 3 bigger buckets. Top levels are levels 5 and 6, and this school had 17% of students reading at the top proficiency levels. Top levels represent high-performing, world-class achievement, according to the OECD. Proficiency levels 2, 3, and 4 can be grouped into intermediate levels, we mostly refer to as proficient. As shown, 74% of this school's students are performing at proficient levels. Below level 2 is considered below baseline level. We usually refer to as below proficiency levels. In 2016, 9% of this school's students are performing below proficiency in reading. From the same school report, I've taken the graphic distribution of proficiency levels shown on the bottom of this slide. The red bars represent this school, the green bars represent U.S. performance. I have drawn in the 3 big bucket sections for this school, the below proficiency levels, 9%, proficient, 74%, and high performing world class, 17% numbers taken from the above table. This school is performing better than the U.S. in the lowest categories, below proficiency. The 2 green bars add to 16% in the lowest level, compared to the 2 red school bars of 9%. In the intermediate proficiency category, the U.S. and this school have similar performance. For the high performing level, the U.S. has 8% of students performing in the world class top levels, compared with this school's 17%. These proficiency graphs of student performance are very useful to our schools, especially now that we have multiple years of data for our leaders and principals to examine. And the goal is to move your students from below level, below proficiency, up to proficient levels, from proficient levels up to world-class levels, to shift the distribution graph to the right. The next slide is a different look at this school's data, but representing only the far right portion of the graph I just showed. We saw in the last slide that in 2016, this school had 17% of its students performing in reading at world-class top levels. With multiple years of data that our district now has, we can look at change over time. This principal now has the information that the school's percent of students reading at world-class proficiency levels has risen from 3% in 2014 to 17% in 2016. I've discussed several aspects of the academic data results from the OECD test for schools, and as mentioned earlier, in addition to that rich data about our students' achievement, the test also captures our students' thoughts and perceptions through the student questionnaire survey. As in every school district, we have things we do well and things we would like to do better. We've looked at academic data, and now we take that perspective into our discussion of student engagement survey results. And this is my last slide. I'd like you to notice that teacher-student relations is a part of the student engagement highlighted by the test survey. And this table shows that the percent of students who marked agree or strongly agree to each of the five statements listed. That percent is shown for 2014, 2015, and 2016. Looking at the first statement only, students get along well with most teachers. In 2014, 78% of students answered agree or strongly agree. Going across, in 2015, 75% agreed or strongly agreed, and in 2016, 66% of students agreed or strongly agreed that students get along well with most teachers. Looking at all questions and the students' responses across the years, many items seem to have a fairly high percent of agree or strongly agree responses. We do note some drop-off, though, in the first item, which suggests the need for further examination of teacher-student relationships in our district. Each school gets the very detailed school report containing graphs and discussion about each school's teacher-student relationship. School leaders can review their own school's data and their programs with their staff. We also have district-wide programs in place to measure and promote student achievement. Student survey results also contain information about students' motivation and their confidence in both math and science. And research has clearly shown the importance of students' engagement, motivation, and confidence for achievement.
Thank you so much, Karen. We really appreciate that rich information about using data. And I tell you, I think the audience could take a pause just to reflect on so much. But we do really thank you for offering that follow-up conversation for the audience, because I could see the need for it. Thank you again. I do have a follow-up question for you on this use of data. How would you say the Test for Schools data has supported the district in advancing the use of data for driving instruction and for student achievement?
Well, our district has always, for decades anyway, used good, reliable data, the information obtained from that, to drive policy and improve student achievement. In 1996, our superintendent was part of establishing the results-based evaluation system, or the RBES system, very rich look at several components over our district, from district level to divisions to school level to principals and down to teacher level for evaluations and assessments. So we've always looked at good data as providing good information and being important. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the OECD test for schools is changing that. It's just improving and enhancing our look at data with the extra information that it provides in international benchmarking, and it enhances our ongoing work with actionable data. For example, one thing that some of our schools have been looking at is their gender differences in academic achievement, and the OECD delves into that information as well as many other information.
Thank you, Karen, and thank you, John, so much for that important information from Gwinnett. So I'm turning to Ashley. Ashley, in the issue brief, it states that taken together, the OECD test for schools has enabled a cultural shift in how Gwinnett principals and teachers view instruction. Mm-hmm. So first question for you, what does the research say about school culture and its impact on student achievement? Mm. And if you could weave that in with the test for schools.
Mm-hmm. So one of the exciting things that emerged as we were writing this brief and speaking to the districts and the schools involved is that this OECD test for schools gave leaders a really important lever for bringing the teachers together, for claiming a high expectation for all students, for setting the bar very high. And it emerged that this amounted to a change in how certainly the principal and district level leaders were able to influence what was going on in the classroom for the betterment of the teachers and the students. Now, why is this important? It's important because whether we're looking at research by James Coleman or Tony Brike on Catholic school effect, which is very powerful, or Karen Chenoweth looking at district schools, or Scott Sider in Boston looking at charter schools, in-school factors that matter greatly are high-end academic rigor and a strong school culture. And by a strong school culture, we really mean an alignment with mission, that this is who we are as a school, this is what we stand for, this is why, and this affects our practices, our school traditions, our rituals, our disciplinary measures, and so on. I think that's what we see in all of these instances, where we're increasing the odds of having a strong school culture and boosting student learning.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask John or Karen or both to expand upon this cultural shift in your Gwinnett County schools.
Well, it's been interesting. And as I'd mentioned before, I'd been around for some time. Prior to No Child Left Behind, we were really doing some pretty good work on developing rigor into our assessment program. And then when No Child Left Behind came, we were required to use the state test. And for us, the state test was a step backwards. It did not have the same level of rigor. And unfortunately, that had, even though there were some very good benefits to No Child Left Behind, it did have an unintended consequence of the level of instruction drop back a little bit, because the level of the state assessment was not at the same level of rigor. So what we see now is an opportunity to kind of return to that challenging, rigorous curriculum and assessment. And what we think is that good assessment drives good instruction. And when we tie our performance to this international standard, we have to pick up our level of instruction. So we hope that this is a little bit of a return to that culture of rigor for our school district.
Absolutely. Thank you. Karen, anything to add?
No, I think John has... That's
fabulous, because the next question also comes to you, John, or Karen, or both. And this question is really about how the test for schools is used to drive the programs or the activities to increase student achievement. So how are we using that data to engage teachers in engaging students? Gwinnett County.
Wow. Well, what I'm trying to do is show teachers, here's what rigorous questions look like, and then engage in the discussion with teachers about what kind of instruction needs to take place to prepare students for this level of rigor. And many welcome this. They see that the OECD test for school questions are based on real life situations. So the students have an additional motivation. They see the relevance of the learning, and they see and they learn how to apply their learning to solve real life problems. So I hope that's answered your question.
Thank you, John, so very much. And back to you two again. In your presentation, Karen, you discussed the Test for Schools data and a focus on students who are historically underserved. Can you discuss how the data are being used, or these data sets are being used to make district-wide changes or school-level changes for those groups of students?
Well, I'm glad you shifted to school level, because our office research, we provide the information, and then there are a lot of very knowledgeable district leaders who take it out to the district. But our district pursues excellence for each student, every student. It doesn't matter whether they're from a low poverty or high poverty school. It's part of our mission. And the most important thing, and I think I alluded to this talking about the proficiency distributions of a school, is that a school can compare itself to it, compare itself year to year, over years. It's kind of deflating, I think, to take a look at where you stand if you've got relatively low performance and you see yourself compared to Shanghai. And so the wonderful thing about our district completing the Test for Schools every year is schools can benchmark against themselves. They can look back and see, okay, last year we did this on this part, you know, we improved for this year. They can also benchmark against schools that are similar to them in context, as I showed with the one graph with socioeconomic status. And every school can focus on their progress over time, academic and with student engagement. It's important, I think, you know, in John's work with middle schools, and instructional rigor requires that teachers and students are engaged. And that's important at every single school, whether high poverty, low poverty. You can't do the kind of rigorous teaching through content and instruction and assessment unless the students are engaged with the teacher. And, you know, as Tony Wagner says, teachers have to question students to build their tolerance for ambiguity. And so that's one thing I think district-wide we can focus on, is getting our kids to stick to it, to persevere, and maybe that's a district-wide, not change, but something we can emphasize over the while. You know, don't give up, keep trying. I don't know if that answered your question, but...
That did. Thank you so much, Karen. And so I'm going to turn back to Ashley. So Ashley, this is a broader question. Mm-hmm. How do you see the Test for Schools informing policy in terms of accountability and or school improvement? Hmm.
Very good question. So that's really two different questions. The first is about school improvement. And there the question is, would the OECD Test for Schools serve as an intervention in the case of targeted interventions under ESSA? And I would say no, because there simply isn't enough research to date that would enable this to be a policy lever under ESSA's, say, Title I funding. The other question is more broad about accountability, as states have to create their accountability structures now that have academic and non-academic measures. I'm not persuaded that the OECD Test for Schools would be a good candidate for an accountability system for two reasons. First is it's not a granular student level measure so much as a representative sample, and thus it doesn't play the same role that a state summative test would. So it's not really designed to give that kind of feedback. But more importantly, right now the OECD Test for Schools is a beneficial lever for all of the adults and the students to continuously learn and continuously improve. When you put something in an accountability system, as we know, it takes on a different contours, different attitudes. It's not perceived as a purely beneficial tool. And I think I would defer to the district leaders on this, but my guess is that it wouldn't be their choice, or perhaps not so desirable as an academic indicator in accountability.
Thank you, Ashley. So I'm going to throw this question out to the entire panel, and Gwyneth can pick up on that particular point if they wish, but it's for everyone. It comes from Marlene who is in the audience today. Thank you, Marlene. And she wants to know, how do we support teachers with best practices so that they can support these Test for Schools items on the assessment?
Mm-hmm. I can start with just a general comment from all of the different case studies that we did. One of the things teachers needed was the reassurance that preparing students for the PISA and using PISA-style questions was actually helpful to them and to their students rather than detracted from their mission of preparing students for the state standards. And one of the impressive things that the leaders in these case studies did was crosswalks between the PISA questions and the state standards that enabled teachers to relax, buy into it, and use it. And I think that was one of the things that jumped out to me. I'm sure they have other examples.
So John, Karen?
That's correct. The crosswalk was very important because that connected with our content, and our teachers feel very responsible for teaching the content and teaching the standards. And so when the stimulus material that is a part of a PISA unit covers that content and teaches that content, the questions that follow up help the students learn that content at a much deeper level. They're able to transfer this information into new situations. They're able to apply the information and to solve problems. And so therefore they retain this information much longer. And we have found that crosswalk was a very important piece and gave some legitimacy to using the questions for instructional purposes in the classroom.
Fabulous.
Could I step back just a second, Winsome, and discuss the accountability part of OECD Test for Schools?
Absolutely.
Actually, the fact that our district, Mr. Wilbanks, our superintendent, made it very clear in 2014 when we first administered the OECD Test for Schools that it would not be used in any way for accountability, that it was meant to be a measure for schools to improve the work they're doing with their students. And I think, as Ashley said, that's an important aspect of us administering the OECD Test for Schools.
Thank you, Karen. Well said, and good points for our audience. And at this time, I'm just going to open it up for final thoughts from all three of the panelists. Just anyone, any final thoughts, maybe starting with you, Ashley?
My final thought is that it takes a lot of courage as a school leader and a district leader to say, we're going to stand up our students to an international benchmark, and we're going to respond to what we find, not only with the academic results, but the school climate results. And I think that is, it's really singularly impressive. And I think it's a model for the country, really. That's,
yeah. Thank you. Final thoughts, Karen, John?
I'd like to say that I totally agree with that. And actually, Dr. Patterson, our Associate Superintendent for Curriculum and Instructional Support, recently presented at our leadership what Ashley had talked about, types of readers, and our district results, and was suggesting there could be or highlighting areas for improvement. And we have 20 high schools with amazing principals, and they are given quite a bit of autonomy or leverage in their work. And I think that's a wonderful thing that they and their staff can look at where they are and hope to improve.
And my final thought is, I've had a recent development, thanks to Ashley's case study article. A local newspaper picked up on that and wrote an article about our involvement in the OECD Test for Schools. Just today, I got a phone call from the Chamber of Commerce asking for me to come and present because their members were very excited that we were choosing to benchmark ourselves against the best education systems in the world. And they wanted to learn more about that. As we know, every community is trying to attract businesses to their area. And many times these are international businesses. And when they see that we are willing to benchmark ourselves against the best, they're excited. and it helps attract business to our community, which is a benefit to all of us.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Karen. These are wonderful final thoughts. I want to thank our three panelists today, Ashley Berner, Karen Johnson, and John Campbell. Thanks so much for all your support and your great work. Please keep in mind that today's event will be archived at allfored.org/webinars. To learn more about the Global Learning Network, please visit globallearningnetwork.americaachieves.org. And about the OECD test for schools, please go to nweea.org/OECD. And once again, we here at the Alliance wish to thank the Kern Family Foundation for its generous support for the Alliance's work around the OECD test for schools. I'm Winsome Waite for the Alliance for Excellent Education. Thanks so much for joining us today.